Chapter 6 The Way of the Eld 1 At around 2 in the afternoon of that day, the 10 of them sat down to what Roland called a rancher's dinner. "During the morning chores you look forward with love," he told his friends later. "During the evening ones, you look back with nostalgia." Eddie thought he was joking, but with Roland you could never be completely sure. What humor he had was dry to the point of desiccation. It wasn't the best meal Eddie had ever had. The banquet put on by the old people in River Crossing still held pride of place in that regard, but after weeks in the woods, subsisting on gunslinger burritos and shitting hard little parcels of rabbit turds maybe twice a week, it was fine fare indeed. And he served out whopping steaks done medium rare and smothered in mushroom gravy. There were beans on the side, wrapped things like tacos and roasted corn. Eddie tried an ear of this and found it tough but tasty. There was coleslaw, which T.N. Jaffords was at pains to tell them had been made by his own wife's hands. There was also a wonderful pudding called Strawberry Cozy. And, of course, there was coffee. Eddie guessed that among the four of them, they must have put away at least a gallon. Even Oi had a little. Jake put down a saucer of the dark, strong brew. Oi sniffed, said, "Cough!" and then lapped it up quickly and efficiently. There was no serious talk during the meal. Food and palaver don't mix was but one of Roland's many little nuggets of wisdom. And yet Eddie learned a great deal from Jaffords and his wife, mostly about how life was lived out here in what Tian and Zelia called the Borderlands. Eddie hoped Susanna, sitting by Overholzer, and Jake, with the youngster Eddie was already coming to think of as Benny the Kid, were learning half as much. He would have expected Roland to sit with Callahan, but Callahan sat with no one. He took his food off a little distance from all of them, blessed himself, and ate alone. Not very much, either. Mad at Overholzer for taking over the show, or just a loner by nature? Hard to tell on such short notice. But if someone had put a gun to his head, Eddie would have voted for the latter. What struck Eddie with the most force was how goddamn civilized this part of the world was. It made Ludd, with its warring grays and pubes, look like the cannibal isles in a boy's sea story. These people had roads, law enforcement, and a system of government that made Eddie think of New England town meetings. There was a town gathering hall, and a feather which seemed to be some sort of authority symbol. If you wanted to call a meeting, you had to send the feather around. If enough people touched it when it came to their place, there was a meeting. If they didn't, there wasn't. Two people were sent to carry the feather, and their count was trusted without question. Eddie doubted if it would work in New York, but for a place like this, it seemed a fine way to run things. There were at least 70 other collars, stretching in a mild arc north and south of Colla Bryn Sturgis. Colla Bryn Lockwood to the south and Colla Amity to the north were also farms and ranches. They also had to endure the periodic depredations of the wolves. Farther south were Colla Bryn Bowse and Colla Staple, containing vast tracts of ranch land, and Jaffords said they suffered the wolves as well, at least he thought so. Farther north, Colla Sen Pinder and Colla Sen Cree, which were farms and sheep. "Farms of a good size," Tian said, "but they're smaller as you go north, Kennet, until you're in the lands where the snows fall, so I'm told. I've never seen it myself, and wonderful cheese is made." "Those of the north wear wooden shoes, or so 'tis said," Zelia told Eddie, looking a little wistful. She herself wore scuffed clodhoppers called shore boots. The people of the Collas traveled little, but the roads were there if they wanted to travel, and trade was brisk. In addition to them, there was the Wye, sometimes called Big River. This ran south of Colla Bryn Sturgis, all the way to the South Seas, or so 'twas said. There were mining collas and manufacturing collas, where things were made by steam press and even, by electricity. And even one colla devoted to nothing but pleasure, gambling and wild, amusing rides and... But here, Tian, who had been talking, felt Zelia's eyes on him and went back to the pot for more beans. and a conciliatory dish of his wife's slaw. "So," Eddie said, and drew a curve in the dirt, "these are the borderlands, the Kalas. An arc that goes north and south for... how far, Azalea?"
"'Tis men's business, so it is," she said.
Then, seeing her own man was still at the embering fire, inspecting the pots, she leaned forward a bit toward Eddie.
"Do you speak in miles or wheels?"
"A little of both, but I'm better with miles," she nodded.
"Mayhap 2,000 miles. So," she pointed north, "and twice that. So."
To the south. She remained that way, pointing in opposite directions, then dropped her arms, clasped her hands in her lap, and resumed her former demure pose.
"And these towns, these Kalas, stretch the whole way?"
"So we're told, if it please you. And the traders do come and go. Northwest of here, the big river splits in two. We call the east branch Divartiti Wai, the little Wai, you might say. Of course, we see more river travel from the north, for the river flows north to south, do you see?"
"I do. And to the east?"
She looked down.
"Thunderclap,"
she said, in a voice Eddie could barely hear.
"None go there."
"Why?"
"It's dark there," said she,
still not looking up from her lap. Then she raised an arm. This time, she pointed in the direction from which Roland and his friends had come, back toward Midworld.
"There," she said, "the world is ending, or so we're told. And there," she pointed east, and now raised her face to Eddie's, "there, in Thunderclap, it's already ended. In the middle are we, who only want to go our way in peace."
"And do you think it'll happen?"
"No."
And Eddie saw she was crying. 2. Shortly after this, Eddie excused himself and stepped into a copse of trees for a personal moment. When he rose from his squat, reaching for some leaves with which to clean himself, a voice spoke from directly behind him.
"Not those, sigh, do it please you. Those be poison flurry. Wipe with those, and how you'll itch."
Eddie jumped and wheeled around, grabbing the waistband of his jeans with one hand and reaching for Roland's gun belt hanging from the branch of a nearby tree with the other. Then he saw who had spoken, or what, and relaxed a little.
"Andy, it's not really kosher to creep up behind people when they're taking a dump."
Then he pointed to a thatch of low green bushes.
"What about those? How much trouble will I get into if I wipe with those?"
There were pauses and clicks.
"What?" Eddie asked. "Did I do something wrong?"
"No," Andy said. "I'm simply processing information, Si. Kosher. Unknown word. Creeping up. I didn't. I walked, if it do you fine. Taking a dump. Likely slang for the excretion of..."
"Yeah," Eddie said. "That's what it is. But listen, if you didn't creep up on me..."
"Andy, how come I didn't hear you? I mean, there's underbrush. Most people make noise when they go through underbrush." "I am not a person, Si," Andy said.
Eddie thought he sounded smug.
"Guy, then. How can a big guy like you be so quiet?" "Programming," Andy said. "Those leaves will be fine, do you?"
Eddie rolled his eyes and grabbed a bunch.
"Oh, yeah, programming. Sure, should have known. Thank you, Si. Long days, kiss my ass and go to heaven." "Heaven," said Andy. "A place one goes after death. A kind of paradise. According to the old fella, those who go to heaven sitteth at the right hand of God the Father Almighty forever and ever." "Yeah? Who's going to sit at his left hand, all the Tupperware salesmen?" "Si, I don't know. Tupperware is an unknown word to me. Would you like your horoscope?"
"Why not?" Eddie said.
He started back toward the camp, guided by the sounds of laughing boys and a barking billy bumbler. Andy towered beside him, shining even beneath the cloudy sky and seeming to not make a sound. It was eerie.
"What's your birth date, Si?"
Eddie thought he might be ready for this one.
"I'm Goat Moon," he said.
Then remembered a little more.
"Goat with beard. Winter's snow is full of woe. Winter's child is strong and wild," said Andy.
Yes, that was smugness in its voice, all right.
"Strong and wild, that's me," Eddie said. "Haven't had a real bath in over a month. You better believe I'm strong and wild. What else do you need, Andy, old guy? Want to look at my palm or anything?" "That will not be necessary, sigh, Eddie."
The robot sounded unmistakably happy, and Eddie thought, "That's me spreading joy wherever I go. Even robots love me. It's my ka." "This is full Earth, say we all thank you. The moon is red, what is called the Huntress Moon in Midworld that was. You will travel, Eddie. You will travel far, you and your friends. This very night you return to Kala, New York. You will meet a dark lady. You—"
"I want to hear more about this trip to New York,"
Eddie said, stopping. Just ahead was the camp. He was close enough so he could see people moving around. "No joking around, Andy."
"You will go todash, sigh, Eddie. You and your friends, you must be careful. When you hear the common, the chimes, Kenya, well, you must all concentrate on each other to keep from getting lost."
"How do you know this stuff?"
Eddie asked.
"Programming," Andy said. "Horoscope is done, Sai. No charge."
And then, what struck Eddie as the final capping lunacy,
"Sai Callahan, the old fella you ken, says I have no license to tell fortunes, so must never charge."
"Sai Callahan says true,"
Eddie said, and then, when Andy started forward again,
"But stay a minute, Andy, do ya, I beg."
It was absolutely weird how quickly that started to sound okay. Andy stopped willingly enough and turned toward Eddie, his blue eyes glowing. Eddie had roughly 1,000 questions about Todash, but he was currently even more curious about something else.
"You know about these wolves?"
"Oh, yes. I told Sai Tian. He was wroth."
Again, Eddie detected something like smugness in Andy's voice. But surely that was just the way it struck him, right? A robot, even one that had survived from the old days, couldn't enjoy the discomforts of humans. Could it? "Didn't take you long to forget the mono, did it, sugar?" Susanna's voice asked in his head. Hers was followed by Jake's, "Blaine's a pain." And then, just his own, "If you treat this guy like nothing more than a fortune-telling machine in a carnival arcade, Eddie, old boy, you deserve whatever you get."
"Tell me about the wolves,"
Eddie said.
"What would you know, sigh, Eddie? Where they come from, for a start. The place where they feel like they can put their feet up and fart right out loud. Who they work for, why they take the kids, and why the ones they take come back ruined."
Then another question struck him, perhaps the most obvious.
"Also, how do you know when they're coming?"
Clicks from inside, Andy. A lot of them this time, maybe a full minute's worth. When Andy spoke again, its voice was different. It made Eddie think about Officer Bosconi back in the neighborhood. Brooklyn Avenue, that was Bosco Bob's beat. If you just met him, walking along the street and twirling his nightstick, Bosco talked to you like you were a human being, and so was he. "How you doing, Eddie? How's your mother these days? How's your good-for-nothing bro? Are you gonna sign up for Pal Midler's? Okay, see you at the gym, stay off the smokes, have a good day." But if he thought maybe you'd done something, Bosco Bob turned into a guy you didn't want to know. That Officer Bosconi didn't smile, and the eyes behind his glasses were like puddle ice in February, which just happened to be the time of the goat over here on this side of the great whatever. Bosco Bob had never hit Eddie, but there were a couple of times, once just after some kids lit Woo Kim's market on fire, when he felt sure that blue suit motherfucker would have hit him, if Eddie had been stupid enough to smart off. It wasn't schizophrenia, at least not of the pure Detta Odetta kind, but it was close. There were two versions of Officer Bosconi. One of them was a nice guy, the other one was a cop. When Andy spoke again, it no longer sounded like your well-meaning but rather stupid uncle, the one who believed the Alligator Boy and Elvis is Alive in Buenos Aires stories, inside you printed, were absolutely true. This Andy sounded emotionless and somehow dead. Like a real robot, in other words.
"What's your password, sigh, Eddie?"
"Huh?"
"Password. You have 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7.
Eddie thought of spy movies he'd seen.
"You mean I say something like, the roses are blooming in Cairo, and you say, only in Mrs. Wilson's garden, and then I say,
incorrect password, sigh, Eddie. 2, 1, 0.
From within Andy came a low, thudding sound, which Eddie found singularly unpleasant. It sounded like the blade of a sharp cleaver passing through meat and into the wood of the chopping block beneath. He found himself thinking for the first time about the old people who had surely built Andy. Or maybe the people before the old people, call them the really old people. Who knew for sure?
Not people Eddie himself would want to meet if the last remainders in Lud had been any example.
"You may retry once," said the cold voice. It bore a resemblance to the one that had asked Eddie if Eddie would like his horoscope told, but that was the best you could call it, a resemblance. "Would you retry, Eddie of New York?"
Eddie thought fast.
"No," he said. "That's all right. The info's restricted, huh?"
Several clicks, then,
"Restricted, confined, kept within certain set limits, as information in a given document or Q-disc, limited to those authorized to use that information. Those authorized announce themselves by giving the password."
Another pause to think, and then Andy said,
"Yes, Eddie, that info's restricted."
"Why?" Eddie asked. He expected no answer, but Andy gave him one.
"Directive 19.
Eddie clapped him on his steel side.
"My friend, that don't surprise me at all. Directive 19 it is." "Would you care to hear an expanded horoscope, Eddie Sy?" "Think I'll pass." "What about a tune called The Jimmy Juice I Drank Last Night? It has many amusing verses."
The reedy note of a pitch pipe came from somewhere in Andy's diaphragm. Eddie, who found the idea of many amusing verses somehow alarming, increased his pace toward the others.
"Why don't we just put that on hold?" he said. "Right now I think I need another cup of coffee." "Give you joy of it, Sy," Andy said.
To Eddie, he sounded rather forlorn, like Bosco Bob when you told him you thought you'd be too busy for Pal League that summer. 3. Roland sat on a stone outcrop, drinking his own cup of coffee. He listened to Eddie without speaking himself, and with only one small change of expression, a minute lift of the eyebrows at the words, "Directive 19. Across the clearing from them, Sleitman the Younger had produced a kind of bubble pipe that made extraordinarily tough bubbles. Oi chased them, popped several with his teeth, then began to get the hang of what Sleitman seemed to want, which was for him to herd them into a fragile little pile of light. The bubble pile made Eddie think of the wizard's rainbow, those dangerous glass balls. And did Callahan really have one? The worst of the bunch? Beyond the boys, at the edge of the clearing, Andy stood with his silver arms folded over the stainless steel curve of his chest, waiting to clean up the meal he had hauled to them and then cooked, Eddie supposed. The perfect servant. He cooks, he cleans, he tells you about the dark lady you'll meet. Just don't expect him to violate Directive 19. Not without the password, anyway. "Come over to me, folks, would you?" Roland asked, raising his voice slightly. "Time we had a bit of palaver. Won't be long, which is good, at least for us, for we've already had our own, before Sy Callahan came to us, and after a while, talk sickens, so it does." They came over and sat near him like obedient children, those from the Kala and those who were from far away and would go beyond here, perhaps even farther. "First I'd hear what you know of these wolves. Eddie tells me Andy may not say how he comes by what he knows."
"You say true," Sleitman the Elder rumbled. "Either those who made him or those who came later have mostly gagged him on that subject, although he always warns us of their coming. On most other subjects his mouth runs everlastingly."
Roland looked toward the Kala's big farmer.
"Will you set us on, Sy Overholzer?"
Tian Jaffords looked disappointed not to be called on. His woman looked disappointed for him. Sleitman the Elder nodded as if Roland's choice of speaker was only to be expected. Overholzer himself did not puff up as Eddie might have guessed. Instead, he looked down at his own crossed legs and scuffed shore boots for 30 seconds or so, rubbing at the side of his face, thinking. The clearing was so quiet, Eddie could hear the minute rasp of the farmer's palm on 2 or 3 days' worth of bristles. At last he sighed, nodded, and looked up at Roland.
"Say thank you. You're not what I expected, I must say. Nor your Tet."
Overholzer turned to Tian.
"You were right to haul us out here, Tian Jeffords. This is a meeting we needed to have, and I say thank you."
"It wasn't me got you out here," Jeffords said. "Was the old fella?"
Overholzer nodded to Callahan. Callahan nodded back.
then sketched the shape of a cross in the air with his scarred hand, as if to say, Eddie thought, that it wasn't him either, but God. Maybe so. But when it came to pulling coals out of a hot fire, he'd put $2 on Roland of Gilead for everyone he put on God and the man Jesus, those heavenly gunslingers. Roland waited, his face calm and perfectly polite. Finally, Overholser began to talk. He spoke for nearly 15 minutes, slowly but always to the point. There was the business of the twins, to begin with. Residents of the Kala realized that children birthed in twos were the exception rather than the rule in other parts of the world, and at other times in the past, but in their area of the Grand Crescent, it was the singletons like the Jaffords' Aaron who were the rarities. The great rarities. And, beginning perhaps 120 years ago, or mayhap 150, with time the way it was, such things were impossible to pin down with any certainty, the wolves had begun their raids. They did not come exactly once every generation. That would have been each 20 years or so, and it was longer than that. Still, it was close to that. Eddie thought of asking Overholser and Sleitman how the old people could have shut Andy's mouth concerning the wolves if the wolves had been raiding out of Thunderclap for less than 2 centuries, then didn't bother. Asking what couldn't be answered was a waste of time, Roland would have said. Still, it was interesting, wasn't it? Interesting to wonder when someone or something had last programmed Andy the Messenger, many other functions. And why? The children, Overholser said, one of each set between the ages of perhaps 3 and 14, were taken east into the land of Thunderclap. Sleitman the Elder put his arm around his boy's shoulders during this part of the tale, Eddie noticed. There they remained for a relatively short period of time, mayhap 4 weeks, mayhap 8. Then most of them would be returned. The assumption made about those few who did not return was that they had died in the land of darkness, that whatever evil rite was performed on them killed a few instead of just ruining them. The ones who came back were at best biddable idiots. A 5-year-old would return with all his hard-won talk gone, reduced to nothing but babble and reaching for the things he wanted. Diapers which had been left forgotten 2 or 3 years before would go back on, and might stay on until such a ruined child was 10 or even 12. "Your bugger, Tia, still pisses herself 1 day out of every 6, and can be counted on to shit herself once a moon as well," Jafford said.
"Hear him," Overholser agreed gloomily. "My own brother, Welland, was much the same until he died. And of course they have to be watched more or less constant, for if they get something they like, they'll eat it until they bust. Who's watching yours, Tian?"
"My cuz," Zalia said before Tian could speak. "Hedden and Hedda can help a little now as well. They've come to a likely enough age." She stopped and seemed to realize what she was saying. Her mouth twisted and she fell silent. Eddie guessed he understood. Hedden and Hedda could help now, yes. Next year one of them would still be able to help. The other one, though. A child taken at the age of 10 might come back with a few rudiments of language left, but would never get much beyond that. The ones who were taken oldest were somehow the worst, for they seemed to come back with some vague understanding of what had been done to them, what had been stolen from them. These had a tendency to cry a great deal, or to simply creep off by themselves and peer into the east, like lost things, as if they might see their poor brains out there circling like birds in the dark sky. Half a dozen such had even committed suicide over the years. At this, Callahan once more crossed himself. The ruined ones remained childlike in stature as well as in speech and behavior until about the age of 16. Then, quite suddenly, most of them sprouted to the size of young giants. "You can have no idea what it's like if you haven't seen it and been through it," Tian said. He was looking into the ashes of the fire. "You can have no idea of the pain it causes them. When a babby cuts his teeth, you ken how they cry?" "Yes," Susanna said. Tian nodded. "It's as if their whole bodies are teething, ken it?"
"Hear him," Overholser said. "For 16 or 18 months, all my brother did was sleep, and eat, and cry, and grow. I can remember him crying even in his sleep. I'd get out of my bed and go across to him, and there'd be a whispering sound from inside his chest and legs and head. 'Twere the sound of his bones growing in the night, hear me?
Eddie contemplated the horror of it. You heard stories about giants, fee-fi-fo-fum and all that, but until now he'd never considered what it might be like to become a giant. As if their whole bodies are teething, Eddie thought, and shivered.
1.5 years. No longer than that, and it were done, but I wonder how long it must seem to them who are brought back with no more sense of time than birds or bugs.
Endless, Susanna said. Her face was very pale, and she sounded ill. It must seem endless.
The whispering in the night says their bones grow, Overholzer said. The headache says their skulls grow.
Zalman screamed one time for 9 days without stopping, Zalia said. Her voice was expressionless, but Eddie could see the horror in her eyes. He could see it very well. His cheekbones pushed up. You could see it happening. His forehead curved out and out, and if you held an ear close to it, you could hear the skull creaking as it spread. It sounded like a tree branch under a weight of ice. 9 days, he screamed. 9. Morning, noon, and in the dead of night. Screaming and screaming, eyes gushing water, we prayed to all the gods there were that he'd go hoarse, that he'd be stricken dumb, even, but none such happened, say thank you. If we'd had a gun, I believe we would have slew him as he lay on his pallet just to end his pain. As it was, my good old da was ready to slit In's throat when it stopped. His bones went on yet a while, his skeleton, do ya, but his head was the worst of it, and it finally stopped, tell God's thank you, and man Jesus too. She nodded toward Callahan. He nodded back and raised his hand toward her, outstretched in the air for a moment. Zelia turned back to Roland and his friends. Now I have 5 of my own, she said. Aaron's safe, and say thank you, but Hedden and Hedda's 10, a prime age. Lyman and Leah's only 5, but 5's old enough. 5's... She covered her face with her hands and said no more. 4.
Once the growth spurt was finished, Overholzer said, some of them could be put to work. Others, the majority, weren't able to manage even such rudimentary tasks as pulling stumps or digging postholes. You saw these sitting on the steps of Took's general store, or sometimes walking across the countryside in gangling groups, young men and women of enormous height, weight, and stupidity, sometimes grinning at each other and babbling, sometimes only goggling up at the sky.
They didn't mate. There was that to be grateful for. While not all of them grew to prodigious size, and their mental skills and physical abilities might vary somewhat, there seemed to be one universal. They came back sexually dead.
"Begging your pardon for the crudity," Overholzer said, "but I don't believe my brother Welland had so much as a piss-hard on after they brought him back. Zelia, have you ever seen your brother with a, you know?"
Zelia shook her head.
"How old were you when they came, Cy Overholzer?"
Roland asked.
"First time, you mean. Welland and I were 9.
Overholzer now spoke rapidly. It gave what he said the air of a rehearsed speech, but Eddie didn't think that was it. Overholzer was a force in Kala Bryn Sturgis. He was, God save us and stone the crows, the big farmer. It was hard for him to go back in his mind to a time when he'd been a child, small and powerless and terrified.
"Our Ma and Pa tried to hide us away in the cellar. So I've been told, anyway. I remember none of it myself, to be sure. Taught myself not to, I suppose. Yeah, quite likely. Some remember better than others, Roland, but all the tales come to the same. One is took, one is left behind. The one took comes back ruined. Maybe able to work a little, but dead in the blow of the waist. Then, when they get in their 30s.
When they reach their 30s, the Runt twins grew abruptly, shockingly old. Their hair turned white and often fell completely out. Their eyes dimmed. Muscles that had been prodigious, as Tia Jaffords and Zalman Hunnicks were now, went slack and wasted away.
Sometimes they died peacefully in their sleep. More often, their endings weren't peaceful at all. The sores came, sometimes out on the skin, but more often in the stomach or the head, in the brain. All died long before their natural span would have been up, had it not been for the wolves, and many died as they had grown from the size of normal children to that of giants, screaming in pain. Eddie wondered how many of these idiots, dying of what sounded to him like terminal cancer, were simply smothered or perhaps fed some strong sedative that would take them far beyond pain, far beyond sleep. It wasn't the sort of question you asked, but he guessed the answer would have been many. Roland sometimes used the word Della, always spoken with a light toss of the hand toward the horizon. Many. The visitors from the Kala, their tongues and memories untied by distress, might have gone on for some time, piling one sorry anecdote on another, but Roland didn't allow them to. "Now speak of the wolves, I beg. How many come to you?"
40, Tian Jafford said.
"Spread across the whole Kala?" Sleitman the elder asked. "Nay, more than 40.
And to Tian, slightly apologetic, "You were no more than 9 yourself last time they came, Tian.
I were in my young 20s. 40 in town, maybe, but more came to the outlying farms and ranches. I'd say 60 in all," Roland sighed. "Maybe 80.
Roland looked at Overholzer, eyebrows raised.
"It's been 23 years, you mind," Overholzer said. "But I'd call 60 about right. You call them wolves, but what are they really? Are they men, or something else?"
Overholzer, Sleitman, Tian, Zelia, for a moment Eddie could feel them sharing Kef, could almost hear them. It made him feel lonely and left out, the way you did when you saw a couple kissing on a street corner, wrapped in each other's arms or looking into each other's eyes, totally lost in each other's regard. Well, he didn't have to feel that way anymore, did he? He had his own Ka-Tet, his own Kef, not to mention his own woman. Meanwhile, Roland was making the impatient little finger-twirling gesture with which Eddie had become so familiar. "Come on, folks," it said, "day's wasting."
"No telling for sure what they are," Overholzer said. "They look like men, but they wear masks."
"Wolf masks," Susanna said.
"Aye, lady, wolf masks, grey as their horses."
"Do you say all come on grey horses?" Roland asked. The silence was briefer this time, but Eddie still felt that sense of Kef and Ka-Tet, minds consulting via something so elemental it couldn't even rightly be called telepathy. It was more elemental than telepathy.
"You're a bugger,"
Overholzer said, a slang term that seemed to mean, "You bet your ass, don't insult me by asking again."
"All on grey horses. They wear grey pants that look like skin. Black boots with cruel big steel spurs, green cloaks and hoods, and the masks. We know they're masks because they've been found left behind. They look like steel but rot in the sun like flesh, buggardly things."
"Ah." Overholzer gave him a rather insulting, head-cocked-to-one-side look, the sort that asked, "Are you foolish or just slow?" Then Sleitman said,
"Their horses ride like the wind. Some have ta'en one babby before the saddle and another behind."
"Do you say so?" Roland asked.
Sleitman nodded emphatically.
"Tell God thank ye."
He saw Callahan again make the sign of the cross in the air and sighed.
"Beg pardon, old fella."
Callahan shrugged.
"You were here before I was. Call on all the gods you like, so long as you know I think they're false. And they come out of Thunderclap," Roland said, ignoring this last. "Aye," Overholzer said. "You can see where it lies over that way, about 100 wheels."
He pointed southeast.
"For we come out of the woods on the last height of land before the crescent. You can see all the eastern plain from there, and beyond it a great darkness like a rain cloud on the horizon. 'Tis said, Roland, that in the far long ago, you could see mountains over there."
"Like the Rockies from Nebraska," Jake breathed. Overholzer glanced at him.
"Beg pardon, Jake, so?"
"Nothing," Jake said, and gave the big farmer a small, embarrassed smile. Eddie, meanwhile, filed away what Overholzer had called him, not sigh, but so. Just something else that was interesting.
We've heard of Thunderclap, Roland said. His voice was somehow terrifying in its lack of emotion. And when Eddie felt Susanna's hand creep into his, he was glad of it.
"'Tis a land of vampires, boggarts and Tahin, so the stories say," Zalia told them. Her voice was thin, on the verge of trembling. "Of course the stories are old."
"The stories are true," Callahan said. His own voice was harsh, but Eddie heard the fear in it. Heard it very well. "There are vampires, other things as well, very likely, and Thunderclap's their nest. We might speak more of this another time, gunslinger, if it does ya. For now, only hear me, I beg. Of vampires, I know a good deal. I don't know if the wolves take the Kala's children to them, I rather think not, but yes, there are vampires."
"Why do you speak as if I doubt?" Roland asked.
Callahan's eyes dropped.
"Because many do. I did myself. I doubted much, and—"
His voice cracked. He cleared his throat, and when he finished, it was almost in a whisper.
"And it was my undoing."
Roland sat quiet for several moments, hunkered on the soles of his ancient boots, with his arms wrapped around his bony knees, rocking back and forth a little. Then to Overholzer, "What are the clock do they come?"
"When they took Welland, my brother, it was morning," the farmer said. "Breakfast not far past. I remember, because Welland asked our ma if he could take his cup of coffee into the cellar with him. But last time, the time they come and took Tian's sister and Zalia's brother and so many others,
I lost two nieces and a nephew," Slightman the elder said.
"That time wasn't long after the noon bell from the gathering hall. We know the day because Andy knows the day, and that much he tells us. Then we hear the thunder of their hooves as they come out of the east, and see the rooster tail of dust they raise."
"So you know when they're coming," Roland said. "In fact, you know three ways. Andy, the sound of their hoofbeats, the rise of their dust."
Overholzer, taking Roland's implication, had flushed a dull brick color up the slopes of his plump cheeks and down his neck.
"They come armed, Roland, do you? With guns, rifles as well as the revolvers your own Tet carries, grenades too, and other weapons as well. Fearsome weapons of the old people, light sticks that kill at a touch, flying metal buzz balls called drones or sneeches. The sticks burn the skin black and stop the heart, electrical maybe, or maybe—"
Eddie heard Overholzer's next word as antnomic. At first he thought the man was trying to say anatomy. A moment later, he realized it was probably atomic.
"Once the drones smell you, they follow no matter how fast you run," Slightman's boy said eagerly. "Or how much you twist and turn, right, da?"
"You're a bugger," Slightman the elder said. "Then sprout blades that whirl around so fast you can't see 'em and they cut you apart."
"All on gray horses," Roland mused. "Every one of them the same color. What else?"
Nothing, it seemed. It was all told. They came out of the east on the day Andy foretold. And for a terrible hour, perhaps longer, the Kala was filled with the thunderous hoofbeats of those gray horses and the screams of desolated parents. Green cloaks swirled, wolf masks that looked like metal and rotted in the sun like skin snarled. The children were taken. Sometimes a few pair were overlooked and left whole, suggesting that the wolves' prescience wasn't perfect. Still, it must have been pretty goddamn good, Eddie thought, because if the kids were moved, as they often were, or hidden at home, as they almost always were, the wolves found them anyway, and in short order. Even at the bottom of sharp-root piles or haystacks, they were found. Those of the Kala who tried to stand against them were shot, fried by the light sticks, lasers of some kind, or cut to pieces by the flying drones. When trying to imagine these latter, he kept recalling a bloody little film Henry had dragged him to. Phantasm, it had been called, down at the old Majestic, corner of Brooklyn and Markey Avenue. Like too much of his old life, the Majestic had smelled of piss and popcorn and the kind of wine that came in brown bags. Sometimes there were needles in the aisles. Not good, maybe, and yet sometimes, usually at night when sleep was long in coming, a deep part of him still cried for the old life of which the Majestic had been a part. Cried for it as a stolen child might cry for his mother. The children were taken,
The hoofbeats receded the way they had come, and that was the end of it.
No, can't be, Jake said. They must bring them back, don't they?
No, Overholzer said. The ruined ones come back on the train, hear me. There's a great junk pile of them I could show you, and... What? What's wrong?
Jake's mouth had fallen open, and he'd lost most of his color.
We had a bad experience on a train not so very long ago, Susanna said. The trains that bring your children back, are they monos?
They weren't. Overholzer, the Jaffords, and the Slightmans had no idea what a mono was, in fact. Callahan, who had been to Disneyland as a teenager, did. The trains which brought the children back were hauled by plain old locomotives, hopefully none of them named Charlie, Eddie thought, driverless, and attached to one or perhaps two open flat cars. The children were huddled on these. When they arrived, they were usually crying with fear, from sunburns as well if the weather west of Thunderclap was hot and clear, covered with food and their own drying shit, and dehydrated into the bargain. There was no station at the railhead, although Overholzer opined there might have been centuries before. Once the children had been offloaded, teams of horses were used to pull the short trains from the rusty railhead. It occurred to Eddie that they could figure out the number of times the wolves had come by counting the number of junked engines, sort of like figuring out the age of a tree by counting the rings on the stump.
How long a trip for them, would you guess? Roland asked, judging from their condition when they arrive.
Overholzer looked at Slightman, then at Tien and Zelia.
2 days? Three?
They shrugged and nodded.
2 or 3 days,
Overholzer said to Roland, speaking with more confidence than was perhaps warranted, judging from the looks of the others.
Long enough for sunburns, and to eat most of the rations there left.
Or paint themselves with them, Slightman grunted.
But not long enough to die of exposure,
Overholzer finished.
If you judge from that how far they were taken from the collar, all I can say is I wish you joy of the riddle, for no one knows what speed the train draws when it's crossing the plains. It comes slow and stately enough to the far side of the river, but that means little.
No, Roland agreed. It doesn't. He considered.
27 days left?
26 now, Callahan said quietly.
One thing, Roland,
Overholzer said. He spoke apologetically, but his jaw was jutting. Eddie thought he'd backslid to the kind of guy you could dislike on sight, if you had a problem with authority figures, that was. And Eddie always had. Roland raised his eyebrows in silent question.
We haven't said yes.
Overholzer glanced at Slightman the Elder as if for support, and Slightman nodded agreement.
You must ken we have no way of knowing you are who you say you are,
Slightman said, rather apologetically.
My family had no books growing up, and there's none out at the ranch. I'm foreman of Eisenhart's Rocking Bee, except for the stock line books, but growing up I heard as many tales of Gilead and Gunslingers and Arthur Eld as any other boy. Heard of Jericho Hill and such blood-and-thunder tales of pretend, but I never heard of a gunslinger missing two of his fingers, or a brown-skinned woman gunslinger, or one who won't be old enough to shave for years yet.
His son looked shocked, and in an agony of embarrassment as well. Slightman looked rather embarrassed himself, but pushed on.
I cry your pardon if what I say offends. Indeed, I do—
hear him well, Overholzer rumbled.
Eddie was starting to think that if the man's jaw jutted out much further, it would snap clean off.
But any decision we make will have long echoes. You must see it so, if we make the wrong one. It could mean the death of our town and all in it. I can't believe what I'm hearing,
Tien Jaffords cried indignantly.
Do you think he's a fraud? Good gods, man, have you not looked at him? Do we not have—
His wife grasped his arm hard enough to pinch white marks into his farmer's tan with the tips of her fingers. Tien looked at her and fell quiet, though his lips were pressed together tightly. Somewhere in the distance, a crow called, and a rusty answered in its slightly shriller voice. Then all was silent. One by one, they turned to Roland of Gilead to see how he would reply. 5. It was always the same, and it made him tired. They wanted help,
but they also wanted references. A parade of witnesses, if they could get them. They wanted rescue without risk, just to close their eyes and be saved. Roland rocked slowly back and forth, with his arms wrapped around his knees. Then he nodded to himself and raised his head. "Jake," he said, "come to me." Jake glanced at Benny, his new friend, then got up and walked across to Roland. Oi walked at his heel, as always. "Andy," Roland said.
"Si,
bring me 4 of the plates we ate from." As Andy did this, Roland spoke to Overholser. "You're going to lose some crockery. When gunslingers come to town, Si, things get broken. It's a simple fact of life." "Roland, I don't think we need—" "Hush now," Roland said, and although his voice was gentle, Overholser hushed at once. "You've told your tale. Now we tell ours." Andy's shadow fell over Roland. The gunslinger looked up and took the plates, which hadn't been rinsed and still gleamed with grease. Then he turned to Jake, where a remarkable change had taken place. Sitting with Benny the Kid, watching Oi do his small, clever tricks and grinning with pride, Jake had looked like any other boy of 12. Carefree and full of the old Dick, likely as not. Now the smile had fallen away, and it was hard to tell just what his age might have been. His blue eyes looked into Roland's, which were of almost the same shade. Beneath his shoulder, the Ruger Jake had taken from his father's desk in another life hung in its docker's clutch. The trigger was secured with a rawhide loop, which Jake now loosened without looking. It took only a single tug. "Say your lesson, Jake, son of Elmer, and be true." Roland half expected either Eddie or Susanna to interfere, but neither did. He looked at them. Their faces were as cold and grave as Jake's. "Good." Jake's voice was also without expression, but the words came out hard and sure.
"I do not aim with my hand. He who aims with his hand has forgotten the face of his father. I aim with my eye. I do not shoot with my hand."
"I don't see what this—"
Overholser began. "Shut up," Susanna said, and pointed a finger at him.
Jake seemed not to have heard. His eyes never left Roland's. The boy's right hand lay on his upper chest, the fingers spread. "He who shoots with his hand has forgotten the face of his father. I shoot with my mind. I do not kill with my gun. He who kills with his gun has forgotten the face of his father." Jake paused, drew in breath, and let it out, speaking. "I kill with my heart." "Kill these," Roland remarked, and with no more warning than that, slung all 4 of the plates high into the air. They rose, spinning and separating, black shapes against the white sky. Jake's hand, the one resting on his chest, became a blur. It pulled the Ruger from the docker's clutch, swung it up, and began pulling the trigger while Roland's hand was still in the air. The plates did not seem to explode one after the other, but rather all at once. The pieces rained down on the clearing. A few fell into the fire, puffing up ash and sparks. 1 or 2 clanged off Andy's steel head. Roland snatched upward, open hands moving in a blur. Although he had given them no command, Eddie and Susanna did the same. Did it even while the visitors from Calla Bryn Sturgis cringed, shocked by the loudness of the gunfire and the speed of the shots.
"Look here at us, do ya, and say thank ye," Roland said.
He held out his hands. Eddie and Susanna did the same. Eddie had caught 3 pottery shards. Susanna had 5, and a shallow cut on the pad of 1 finger. Roland had snatched a full dozen pieces of falling shrapnel. It looked like almost enough to make a whole plate were the pieces glued back together. The 6 from the collar stared, unbelieving. Benny the Kid still had his hands over his ears. Now he lowered them slowly. He was looking at Jake as one might look at a ghost or an apparition from the sky.
"My God," Callahan said. "It's like a trick in some old Wild West show."
"It's no trick," Roland said. "Never think it. It's the way of the Eld. We are of that Antet, Kef and Ka, watch and warrant. Gunslingers, do you? And now I'll tell you what we will do." His eyes sought Overholser's. "What we will do, I say, for no man bids us. Yet I think nothing I say will discomfort you too badly. If mayhap it does, Roland shrugged. If it does, too bad, that shrug said. He dropped the pottery shards between his boots and dusted his hands. If those had been wolves, he said, there would have been 56 left to trouble you instead of 60. 4 of them lying dead on the ground before you could draw a breath, killed by a boy. He gazed at Jake. What you would call a boy, mayhap. Roland paused. We're used to long odds.
The young fellow's a breathtaking shot, I'd grant you, said Slightman the elder. But there's a difference between clay dishes and wolves on horseback.
For you, Cy, perhaps. Not for us. Not once the shooting starts. When the shooting starts, we kill what moves. Isn't that why you sought us? Suppose there can't be shot, Overholzer asked. Can't be laid low by even the hardest of hard calibers. Why do you waste time when time is short? Roland asked evenly. You know they can be killed, or you never would have come out here to us in the first place. I didn't ask, because the answer is self-evident. Overholzer had once more flushed dark red. Cry your pardon, he said. Benny, meanwhile, continued to stare at Jake with wide eyes, and Roland felt a minor pang of regret for both boys. They might still manage some sort of friendship, but what had just happened would change it in fundamental ways, turn it into something quite unlike the usual light-hearted kef boys shared. Which was a shame, because when Jake wasn't being called upon to be a gunslinger, he was still only a child. Close to the age Roland himself had been when the test of manhood had been thrust on him. But he would not be young much longer, very likely, and it was a shame. Listen to me now, Roland said, and hear me very well. We leave you shortly to go back to our own camp and take our own counsel. Tomorrow, when we come to your town, we'll put up with one of you.
Come to 7 Mile, Overholzer said. We'll have you and say thank you, Roland.
Our place is much smaller, Tien said, but Zelia and I...
We'd be so pleased to have you, Zelia said. She had flushed as deeply as Overholzer.
Aye, we would,
Roland said. Do you have a house as well as a church, Cy Callahan?
Callahan smiled.
I do, and tell God thank you. We might stay with you on our first night in Calla Bryn Sturgis, Roland said. Could we do that?
Sure, and welcome.
You could show us your church. Introduce us to its mysteries.
Callahan's gaze was steady.
I'd welcome the chance to do that.
In the days after, Roland said, smiling, we shall throw ourselves on the hospitality of the town.
You'll not find it wanting, Tien said. That I promise you.
Overholzer and Slightman were nodding.
If the meal we've just eaten is any sign, I'm sure that's true. We say thank ye, Cy Jeffords. Thank ye one and all. For a week, we 4 will go about your town, poking our noses here and there, mayhap a bit longer, but likely a week. We'll look at the lay of the land, and the way the buildings are set on it. Look with an eye to the coming of these wolves. We'll talk to folk, and folk will talk to us. Those of you here now will see to that, aye?
Callahan was nodding.
I can't speak for the many, but I'm sure the rest will be more than willing to talk to you about the wolves. God and man Jesus knows they're no secret. And those of the Crescent are frightened to death of them. If they see a chance you might be able to help us, they'll do all you ask.
The many will speak to me as well, Roland said. I've held palaver with them before.
Don't be carried away with the old fellow's enthusiasm, Roland,
Overholzer said. He raised his plump hands in the air, a gesture of caution.
There are others in town you'll have to convince.
Von Eisenhart, for one, said Slightman.
Aye, and Ebentuk, do you?
Overholzer said.
The general store's the only thing his name's on, ye ken, but he owns the boarding house and the restaurant out front of it, as well as a half interest in the livery and loan paper on most of the small holds hereabouts.
When it comes to the small holds, he mustn't neglect Bucky Javier,
Overholzer rumbled.
He ain't the biggest of them, but only because he gave away half of what he had to his young sister when she married.
Overholzer leaned toward Roland, his face alight with a bit of town history about to be passed on.
Roberta Javier, Bucky's sister, she's lucky, he said. When the wolves came last time, she and her twin brother were but a year old, so they were passed over.
Bucky's own twin brother was took the time before, Slightman said. Bully's dead now almost 4 year. Of the sickness. Since then, there ain't enough Bucky can do for those younger two, but you should talk to him, aye. Bucky's not got but 80 acre, yet he's trig.
Roland thought, they still don't see. Thank you, he said. What lies directly ahead for us comes down to looking and listening, mostly. When it's done, we'll ask that whoever is in charge of the feather take it around so that a meeting can be called. At that meeting, we'll tell you if the town can be defended and how many men will want to help us, if it can be done. Roland saw Overhauser puffing up to speak and shook his head at him. It won't be many we'd want in any case, he said. We're gunslingers, not an army. We think differently, act differently than armies do. We might ask for as many as 5 to stand with us, probably fewer, only 2 or 3. But we might need more to help us prepare.
Why?
Benny asked. Roland smiled. That I can't say yet, son. Because I haven't seen how things are in your collar. But in cases like this, surprise is always the most potent weapon, and it usually takes many people to prepare a good surprise.
The greatest surprise to the wolves, Tien said, would be if we fought at all.
Suppose you decide the collar can't be defended, Overhauser asked. Tell me that, I beg. Then I and my friends will thank you for your hospitality and ride on, Roland said, for we have our own business farther along the path of the beam. He observed Tien's and Zalia's crestfallen faces for a moment, then said, I don't think that's likely, you know. There's usually a way. May the meeting receive your judgment favorably, Overhauser said. Roland hesitated. This was the point where he could hammer the truth home should he want to. If these people still believed a tet of gunslingers would be bound by what farmers and ranchers decided in a public meeting, they really had lost the shape of the world as it once was. But was that so bad? In the end, matters would play out and become part of his long history, or not. If not, he would finish his history and his quest in Calla Bryn Sturgis, mouldering beneath a stone. Perhaps not even that. Perhaps he'd finish in a dead heap somewhere east of town, he and his friends with him, so much rotting meat to be picked over by the crows and the rusties. Ka would tell. It always did. Meanwhile, they were looking at him. Roland stood up, wincing at a hard flare of pain in his right hip as he did so. Taking their cues from him, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake also got to their feet. We're well met, Roland said. As for what lies ahead, there will be water if God wills it. Callahan said, Amen. Chapter 7 Todash 1
Grey horses, Eddie said.
Aye, Roland agreed.
50 or 60 of them, all on grey horses.
Aye, so they did say.
And didn't think it the least bit strange, Eddie mused.
No, they didn't seem to.
Is it?
50 or 60 horses, all the same color? I'd say so, yes.
These collar folk raised horses themselves.
Aye.
Brought some for us to ride. Eddie, who had never ridden a horse in his life, was grateful that at least had been put off, but didn't say so.
Aye, tethered over the hill.
You know that for a fact?
Smelled 'em. I imagine the robot had the keeping of them.
Why would these folks take 50 or 60 horses all the same shade as a matter of course?
Because they don't really think about the wolves or anything to do with them, Roland said. They're too busy being afraid, I think.
Eddie whistled 5 notes that didn't quite make a melody. Then he said, Grey horses.
Roland nodded, Grey horses.
They looked at each other for a moment, then laughed. Eddie loved it when Roland laughed. The sound was dry, as ugly as the calls of those giant blackbirds he called rusties, but he loved it. Maybe it was just that Roland laughed so seldom. It was late afternoon.
Overhead, the clouds had thinned enough to turn a pallid blue that was almost the color of sky. The Overholzer party had returned to their camp. Susanna and Jake had gone back along the forest road to pick more muffin balls. After the big meal they'd packed away, none of them wanted anything heavier. Eddie sat on a log, whittling. Beside him sat Roland, with all their guns broken down and spread out before him on a piece of deerskin. He oiled the pieces one by one, holding each bolt and cylinder and barrel up to the daylight for a final look before setting it aside for reassembly. "You told them it was out of their hands," Eddie said, "but they didn't ken that any more than they did the business about all those gray horses. And you didn't press it."
"Only would have distressed them," Roland said. "There was a saying in Gilead, let evil wait for the day on which it must fall."
"Uh-huh," Eddie said. "There was a saying in Brooklyn, you can't get snot off a suede jacket." He held up the object he was making. It would be a top, Roland thought, a toy for a baby. And again he wondered how much Eddie might know about the woman he lay down with each night. The women. Not on the top of his mind, but underneath. "If you decide we can help them, then we have to help them. That's what Eld's Way really boils down to, doesn't it?"
"Yes," Roland said.
"And if we can't get any of them to stand with us, we stand alone."
"Oh, I'm not worried about that," Roland said.
He had a saucer filled with light, sweet gun oil. Now he dipped the corner of a chamois rag into it, picked up the spring clip of Jake's Ruger, and began to clean it.
"Tian Jaffords would stand with us, come to that. Surely he has a friend or two who'd do the same, regardless of what their meeting decides. In a pinch, there's his wife."
"And if we get them both killed, what about their kids? They have five. Also, I think there's an old guy in the picture. One of them's Grampy. They'd probably take care of him, too."
Roland shrugged.
A few months ago, Eddie would have mistaken that gesture and the gunslinger's expressionless face for indifference. Now he knew better. Roland was as much a prisoner of his rules and traditions as Eddie had ever been of heroin. "What if we get killed in this little town, screwing around with these wolves?" Eddie asked. "Isn't your last thought going to be something like, I can't believe what a putz I was throwing away my chance to get to the Dark Tower in order to take up for a bunch of snot-nosed brats, or similar sentiments?"
"Unless we stand true, we'll never get within 1,000 miles of the tower," Roland said. "Would you tell me you don't feel that?"
Eddie couldn't, because he did. He felt something else as well, a species of bloodthirsty eagerness. He actually wanted to fight again. Wanted to have a few of these wolves, whatever they were, in the sights of one of Roland's big revolvers. There was no sense kidding himself about the truth. He wanted to take a few scalps. Or wolf masks.
"What's really troubling you, Eddie? I'd have you speak while it's just you and me."
The gunslinger's mouth quirked in a thin, slanted smile.
"Do you, I beg?"
"Shows, huh?" Roland shrugged and waited. Eddie considered the question. It was a big question. Facing it made him feel desperate and inadequate, pretty much the way he'd felt when faced with the task of carving the key that would let Jake Chambers through into their world. Only then he'd had the ghost of his big brother to blame, Henry whispering deep down in his head that he was no good, never had been, never would be. Now it was just the enormity of what Roland was asking. Because everything was troubling him. Everything was wrong. Everything. Or maybe wrong was the wrong word, and by 180 degrees, because in another way things seemed too right, too perfect, too... "Ah," Eddie said. He grabbed bunches of hair on both sides of his head and pulled. "I can't think of a way to say it."
"Then say the first thing that comes into your mind. Don't hesitate."
19, Eddie said. "This whole deal has gone 19. He fell backward onto the fragrant forest floor, covered his eyes, and kicked his feet like a kid doing a tantrum. He thought, maybe killing a few wolves will set me right. Maybe that's all it will take.
2. Roland gave him a full minute by count, and then said,
"Do you feel better?"
Eddie sat up. Actually, I do.
Roland nodded, smiling a little. Then can you say more? If you can't, we'll let it go, but I've come to respect your feelings, Eddie, far more than you realize, and if you'd speak, I'd hear. What he said was true. The gunslinger's initial feelings for Eddie had wavered between caution and contempt for what Roland saw as his weakness of character. Respect had come more slowly. It had begun in Balazar's office when Eddie had fought naked. Very few men Roland had known could have done that. It had grown with his realization of how much Eddie was like Cuthbert. Then, on the Mono, Eddie had acted with a kind of desperate creativity that Roland could admire but never equal. Eddie Dean was possessed of Cuthbert Allgood's always puzzling and sometimes annoying sense of the ridiculous. He was also possessed of Alan Johns's deep flashes of intuition. Yet in the end, Eddie was like neither of Roland's old friends. He was sometimes weak and self-centered, but possessed of deep reservoirs of courage and courage's good sister, what Eddie himself sometimes called heart. But it was his intuition Roland wanted to tap now.
All right, then, Eddie said. Don't stop me. Don't ask questions. Just listen.
Roland nodded, and hoped Susanna and Jake wouldn't come back, at least not just yet.
I look in the sky, up there where the clouds are breaking right this minute, and I see the number 19 written in blue.
Roland looked up, and yes, it was there. He saw it too.
But he also saw a cloud like a turtle, and another hole in the thinning dreck that looked like a gunny wagon. I look in the trees and see 19. Into the fire, see 19. Names make 19, like Overholzer's and Callahan's. But that's just what I can say, what I can see, what I can get hold of.
Eddie was speaking with desperate speed, looking directly into Roland's eyes.
Here's another thing. It has to do with Todash. I know you guys sometimes think everything reminds me of getting high, and maybe that's right, but Roland, going Todash is like being stoned.
Eddie always spoke to him of these things as if Roland had never put anything stronger than graph into his brain and body in all his long life. And that was far from the truth. He might remind Eddie of this at another time, but not now.
Just being here in your world is like going Todash, because... Ah, man, this is hard. Roland, everything here is real, but it's not.
Roland thought of reminding Eddie this wasn't his world, not anymore. For him, the City of Lud had been the end of Midworld and the beginning of all the mysteries that lay beyond. But again, kept his mouth closed. Eddie grasped a handful of duff, scooping up fragrant needles and leaving 5 black marks in the shape of a hand on the forest floor.
Real, he said. I can feel it and smell it.
He put the handful of needles to his mouth and ran out his tongue to touch them.
I can taste it. And at the same time, it's as unreal as a 19 you might see in the fire, or that cloud in the sky that looks like a turtle. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand it very well, Roland murmured.
The people are real. You, Susanna, Jake, that guy Gasher who snatched Jake, Overholzer and the Slightmans. But the way stuff from my world keeps showing up over here, that's not real. It's not sensible or logical either, but that's not what I mean. It's just not real. Why do people over here sing, Hey Jude? I don't know. That cyborg bear, Shardik. Where do I know that name from? Why did it remind me of rabbits? All that shit about the Wizard of Oz, Roland, all that happened to us, I have no doubt of it, but at the same time, it doesn't seem real to me. It seems like Todash, like 19. And what happens after the Green Palace? Why, we walk into the woods, just like Hansel and Gretel. There's a road for us to walk on, muffin balls for us to pick. Civilization has ended, everything is coming unraveled. You told us so. We saw it in Lud. Except guess what? It's not. Booyah, assholes, got you again.
Eddie gave a short laugh. It sounded shrill and unhealthy. When he brushed his hair back from his forehead, he left a dark smear of forest earth on his brow.
The joke is that out here, a billion miles from nowhere, we come upon a storybook town, civilized, decent, the kind of folks you feel you know. Maybe you don't like them all. Overholzer's a little hard to swallow, but you feel you know him.
Eddie was right about that, too.
Roland thought. He hadn't even seen Kala Bryn Sturgis yet, and already it reminded him of Magus. In some ways that seemed perfectly reasonable. Farming and ranching towns the world over bore similarities to each other, but in other ways it was disturbing. Disturbing as hell. The sombrero Sleitman had been wearing, for instance, was it possible that here, thousands of miles from Magus, the men should wear similar hats? He supposed it might be. But was it likely that Sleitman's sombrero should remind Roland so strongly of the one worn by Miguel, the old mozo at seafront in Magus all those years before? Or was that only his imagination? As for that, Eddie says, I have none, he thought. The storybook town has a fairy tale problem, Eddie was continuing. And so the storybook people call on a band of movie show heroes to save them from the fairy tale villains. I know it's real. People are going to die, very likely, and the blood will be real, the screams will be real, the crying afterward will be real, but at the same time, there's something about it that feels no more real than stage scenery.
And New York? Roland asked. How did that feel to you?
The same, Eddie said. I mean, think about it. 19 books left on the table after Jake took Charlie the Choo-Choo and the riddle book. And then, out of all the hoods in New York, Balazar shows up, that fuck. Hear, hear, now, Susanna called merrily from behind them. No profanity, boys. Jake was pushing her up the road, and her lap was full of muffin balls. They both looked cheerful and happy. Roland supposed that eating well earlier in the day had something to do with it. Roland said, sometimes that feeling of unreality goes away. Doesn't it? It's not exactly unreality, Roland. It... Never mind splitting nails to make tacks. Sometimes it goes away. Doesn't it? Yes, Eddie said. When I'm with her. He went to her, bent, kissed her. Roland watched them, troubled.